dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour for the battle space of the war for the free world. And I'm very pleased to say we have with us as our first guest a man who is at the forefront of the effort in the United States Congress to wage that war effectively and to ensure that we have in our military, most especially, the kit, the readiness that is required both to deter war wherever possible and, if necessary, to prevail in it. His name is Congressman Rob Whitman. He is the representative of the 1st Congressional District of Virginia, now in his third term. He is also, very much relevant to our topic today, the chairman of the Readiness Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee. He also serves on its Sea Power Subcommittee. And Congressman, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's very good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, it's great to be with you.
You have recently written a very important sort of warning, I would say, in Real Clear Defense about the hollowing out of our military. And I wonder if you might give us some sense from your perspective as to how that is translating specifically into real damage to the readiness of our forces at a difficult and perhaps increasingly dangerous time.
Well, Frank, I'm concerned at a number of levels. And as you pointed out, we are in a very dangerous time. We see emerging threats around the world, not just the conventional threats that we think about with Russia and China and with building threats in North Korea, in Iran, but also asymmetric threats with non-state actors and those folks that are out there perpetrating terrorism throughout the world. Those should all be very concerning to us. And those threats continue to mount, as well as building efforts there in Central Africa and in the Middle East and places like Syria, Egypt, and Libya. So the world we live in is extraordinarily dangerous. And during these times, as we look at reductions to military budgets, and we've seen a procession of these reductions going back to Secretary Gates, my concern is twofold. First of all, is that what makes our fighting force the world's best is the level of training and the level of skill of those all-volunteer force men and women that are there each and every day defending this nation, and also the equipment and hardware that they have at their avail to do their job. I want to make sure that that's kept up to date, that it's also modernized, but also that we have enough of that equipment out there, whether it's ships, whether it's aircraft, whether it's land vehicles, whatever it may be. My concern is both twofold, and you know that the most important part of our force is not necessarily hardware, but that's an important instrument of the force. But the most important part is the skill level and the level of training that our men and women have that I believe makes us the greatest fighting force the world's ever known. That, in my mind, is on the path to degrade, and as it degrades, that takes away our readiness, and that makes us less able to face the threats that are out there today across the world.
Yeah. Congressman Rob Whitman, are you seeing signs of that degrading of our readiness? I was at a conference over the weekend in Dallas with our friend Bill Gertz, and he shared with me one anecdote which suggests this is a real problem, but I'm sure you've got many more. He said that, and I know you're a co-chairman of the Shipbuilding Caucus and a strong advocate of the Navy in the Congress, that we are looking at 80% of the non-deployed assets in the United States Navy being unready to put to sea. Now, I know some are always, you know, in refit and all that, but this seems like an extraordinarily high percentage and suggests a military that's totally unable to surge if we need them to.
Well, that's a big concern. The operation and maintenance budgets there and the amount of service availabilities that are not being lived up to. In other words, ships not going to dry dock to be fixed, and that shortens the life of ships. One thing that concerns me, the Navy is going to retire an additional 9 ships sooner than the end of their service lives by the end of 2015. We gave them money to extend the service, yet they're still going to retire them much earlier. 7 cruisers, 2 amphibs. That puts us down to a total fleet in 2015 of 270 ships. Now, by any measure, we ought to be in the 300s, and that number has floated anywhere from 330 down to as low as 306. But that being said, you can see where we are. That's terribly disturbing to me. And what happens is, because the dollars haven't been put into the maintenance of those ships until very recently, and then in the future we're looking at dropping the maintenance schedules off of these ships, we are going to be retiring ships faster than we build them. And by any measure, that's extraordinarily troubling. Another issue is the level of training. Look at the Air Force. The Air Force now, instead of making sure that all of their fighter pilots are trained and ready to go to combat, now what they're doing is rotating those pilots in and out of training. So only a third of their fighter wings will be fully trained, combat ready. The other two-thirds will be sitting behind a desk waiting to rotate into a training regime where they can go fly and be ready. Now, to me, when you need to surge, and remember, when we surge, those pilots are going to go to battle whether they're trained or not. We're doing them a disservice by saying, sorry, we're not going to make sure that you have the level of training necessary to make sure that you're combat ready.
Yeah. Congressman Rob Whitman is our guest. He is the chairman of the Readiness Subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee. And I'm so glad you made this point, Congressman, because it's, I think, lost on most of us how vital that training is. The qualitative edge of our forces is as important oftentimes as is the caliber of their equipment, and that resides very heavily, as you know, in how prepared they are to do their missions. And this is really troubling information. I guess the same is true as well of the Army and the Marines. I know they're cutting the size of their forces dramatically. Are you also seeing, both in the training and in the operational readiness of the force in those two services as well, similar degradation?
Well, we are. You know, the Army is reducing 8 brigade combat teams for the total of about 80,000 soldiers. The Marine Corps is reducing by about 20,000 Marines. My concern is, again, the training regimes there and making sure that they keep up the training regimes. The Army is going through a refocus on how they reconstitute their force, with the reduction of 8 brigade combat teams going to a more regional concept. The difficulty is in transitioning to that, there's always that gap, and that is, what happens in the meantime? How do you make sure that you continue operations? How do you train up for this new structure of how they're brigade combat teams will operate? All of those things are of deep concern to me. You know, the Marine Corps has always been at the forefront of making sure that their Marines are trained. They're going to be facing a new challenge coming out of a land war in Afghanistan, but now getting back to their traditional mission of being an amphibious expeditionary force, and making sure that those Marines are trained for that, to make sure that they are the first force to deploy anywhere around the world where there's trouble, and they haven't had that level of training to this particular point. My concern is how are they going to be able to ramp that up and make sure that they have that capability going forward? Those are different elements, both within the Army and Marine Corps, that should also be very, very concerning to us as we look at how we maintain readiness.
Well, this is happening, as you know so well, Congressman Rob Whitman, against the backdrop of threats intensifying. And in fact, I'd like to get your quick comments on a report that's just been issued by the Pentagon about China, and what has been described by one observer as apparent steps being taken to put it on a war footing. Don Rumsfeld has said weakness is provocative. What you've just described would be alarming enough if it were happening in a relatively benign environment. But talk to me about your sense of how this stacks up at a moment when China, most especially, seems to be arming to the teeth and asserting itself ever more aggressively, not just in the South China Sea, but around the world.
Well, they are. They are ramping up a conventional force to counter and surpass the United States forces. And there's only one way that you can read that. If you look at what they're doing with shipbuilding, as you know, they bought an old aircraft carrier from Russia. They now have put it to sea. They've now operationalized it with having aircraft flying off the deck. They're building a new aircraft carrier. And there's only one reason that you build an aircraft carrier, and that's to project power around the world, not just to defend territorial seas, but to project power around the world. In addition, if you look at the other systems that they are putting in place, anti-access, to make sure that they deny our ability to patrol off of their coast and keep us a long distance away, is another place where I'm very, very concerned about what do we do as a counter to that. So China is building a significant force, not just a naval force, which is really, I think, the tip of the spear as far as being able to project power, but also what they're doing in building up their conventional forces and also their nuclear strategic forces.
Congressman Rob Whitman, we have to let it go at that. I'm afraid we are just out of time. We'll be speaking more with Rick Fisher, a great expert on these subjects, in the next segment. We'll drill down more deeply, but we appreciate, sir, your service to our country on the Armed Services Committee and in the House of Representatives, and we'll look forward to visiting with you at greater length in the future, if you will. Thank you,
sir.
Very
good.
We'll talk
Frank.
Next up, Rick Fisher. Straight ahead.
Tackling the biggest issues of life. He's Dennis Prager.
I have argued before you that the greatest amount of evil is done by people thinking that they're doing good.
That is why the heart is the worst possible guide to goodness.
Sincerity ain't worth a hill of beans when it comes to goodness.
The Dennis Prager Show. Weekdays at noon, right before Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined this segment by Richard Fisher, one of our country's great authorities on Chinese military power and what is happening in that realm. It is an opportune moment to talk with Rick, as he is, among others, helping us to understand this new report issued by the Pentagon about China's military buildup. Rick is quoted by our friend Bill Gertz in the Washington Free Beacon today in terms of talking about a China that is clearly preparing in the short term and long term for small scale and large scale war with the United States, its allies and interests. Rick is a senior fellow on Asian military affairs with the International Assessment and Strategy Center. His latest book is China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. Rick, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, especially in the aftermath of this new report.
Frank, thanks for having me back.
Let's just drill down a little bit on that proposition that I just mentioned. You really see this unmistakably as a buildup that is intentional and very much aimed at us. Is that right?
Absolutely. For decades, the usual wisdom in Washington, especially amongst academic PLA analysts or analysts of China's military, have tried to describe China's military buildup and modernization as defensive, as a natural consequence of skipping generations of modernization because of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution. But in my opinion, in my analysis, since the Tiananmen massacres of 1989, China's trajectory has been to build an offensive, combat-capable force that will be increasingly ready to wage small-scale conflicts during the latter part of this decade and much larger conflicts going into the next decade and beyond. And we're the target. The United States is the target.
Indeed. We're joined once again by Richard Fisher. He is a senior fellow with the International Assessment and Strategy Center. And Rick, we were talking about this report out of the Pentagon, and you were making the point that China is indeed building up for a war footing. We talked with Congressman Whitman a moment ago about different components of that, both on the conventional and the nuclear side. Let's go down in some detail on how this is manifesting itself, according to even the Pentagon now, as well as, of course, your own excellent research, in the various component parts of this buildup. Perhaps we might start with the submarine force that the Chinese are amassing.
Yes, the report offers new details that in addition to three second-generation SSBNs, two more are
those being are ballistic
built.
Missile submarines, of course.
Right, carrying nuclear missiles,
yep.
Part of their second strike capability. But now they are developing a successor class already, the Type 096, and that will most likely have a new ballistic missile that I believe will be able to carry multiple warheads.
Would that constitute a first strike capability, and are we seeing some doctrinal shifts on that score?
China has made great hay since the 1960s, telling the world that it has a nuclear doctrine of no first use, meaning its nuclear forces are completely for retaliation. But few serious analysts believe this, especially in terms of theater campaigns, such as against Taiwan, Korean Peninsula. There's a growing belief that China may actually use tactical nuclear weapons very early in an offensive surprise strike. So China is playing a game of deception.
Indeed. Rick Fisher, one of the other places where we're seeing ballistic missiles being brought to bear, and it is very alarming, I gather, to the United States Navy these days, is in what Congressman Whitman called sort of an aerial denial capability. Talk to us about the DF-21 and what role it would play in this larger scheme of things, of China warfare against the United States.
The Pentagon report for the first time says that the DF-21D Delta anti-ship ballistic missile has been deployed. This means there is now some capability to use a ballistic missile to hit moving large warships like aircraft carriers. We have questionable defenses against such a weapon. If we had lasers and railguns, then we would have a chance at defending our large ships, but today we do not. These missiles will be used in coordination with aircraft, smaller cruise missiles, submarines, all designed to stop our Navy from coming to the rescue of our allies.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, one of the takeaways from the Pentagon report, Rick Fisher, is the extent to which this really is a seamless web of intersecting and mutually reinforcing capabilities, whether they're fighters, whether they're space control systems. Let's talk a little bit about computer hacking as well as an offensive technique. And Rick, there's a report in National Public Radio today about this that focused largely on the Chinese hacking American companies in China. But I think as Mandian, one of the groups that has studied this closely, has pointed out, this is a much more comprehensive pillaging of our technology base, including companies here in the United States, as well as our government, isn't it?
Well, consider China's hacking campaign like a massive searchlight. Every nook and cranny that the light can get into, it is going to try to steal whatever it touches. And millions of hacking commands take place automatically every day, and every weakness is being probed. Every possible chance for gaining militarily useful information is being exercised. And the Chinese really aren't going to stop this until we do something dramatic, like sending home their 700,000 students learning the next generation of technology at our universities.
Wow. And speak to me, if you would, Rick Fisher, about the extent to which this searchlight or systematic theft operation is translating into cost avoidance for the Chinese military as it engages in this buildup at our expense.
Well, in October last year, it flew for the first time a new stealthy twin-engine fighter. If you look at this fighter, you will see that it uses design influences from a famous American company called Lockheed Martin. It combines design aspects from both of Lockheed's fighters, the F-22 and the newer F-35. And this is not an accident. It's been well reported that Lockheed has been a primary target of egregious Chinese cyber thefts. And this information has been applied to a new Chinese fighter. And yes, at no cost to the Chinese taxpayers, whereas the F-35 remains a very expensive burden for the American taxpayer, a necessary but expensive burden.
Indeed, and maybe at greater risk as a result of the efforts that the Chinese have made to not only copy it but to counter it. Rick, just very quickly, and we've got less than a minute left, your sense of whether the United States is now adequately understanding and beginning to respond appropriately to these Chinese buildups?
Well, thanks to the Congress, and especially to the chairman of our House Armed Services Committee, this year's report is twice as long as last year's China military report, and it does a much better job of alerting the American people and the Congress to the dangers that we face. Is it enough? No. But it's a far better report than last year's.
Rick Fisher, your own reports on these subjects are required reading, including your book, China's Military Modernization and Building for Regional and Global Reach. Thanks for the work you do with the International Assessment and Strategy Center. Keep coming back with us again very soon.
Thank you, Frank.
Andy McCarthy joins us. We'll be talking with him about the latest Boston Massacre. Much more straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt, keep
keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Obama administration sure seems determined to destroy the U.S. military. The president is insisting on Pentagon spending cuts that are hollowing out our armed forces as he negotiates away our missile defenses and abandons our nuclear deterrent. Then there are the serial attacks on the culture of the military, from imposing open homosexuality to obliging women to serve in combat. Army reservists have been trained to view Catholics and evangelical Christians as extremists on a par with Al-Qaeda. And the Air Force is taking counsel from someone who thinks Christians in uniform are monsters who should be prosecuted for treason if they share their faith with other service personnel. Heaven help us if, after all this, it turns out we once again need the military. Our commander-in-chief is breaking. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed four Americans in Benghazi, Libya last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate, and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week at this hour, by our friend Andy McCarthy. He is our duty expert on matters involving the nexus between national security and the law, among many other things. He is the best-selling author of three absolutely terrific books, Willful Blindness, The Grand Jihad, and Spring Fever, most recently. He is a columnist with National Review Online and PJ Media, and a former federal prosecutor, and a great contributor to this program. Andy, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Frank, great to be with you.
You have been writing in your inimitable fashion a lot and brilliantly of late, and I wanted to just sort of give people a flavor of some of the high points of it. Start, if you would, with kind of your latest musings on what's coming out of the investigation/prosecution in Boston associated with the massacre there last month. Specifically, your thoughts on the Mirandizing of the man accused of perpetrating it, Zohar Tsarnaev.
Well, I think it was a mistake, Frank, to Mirandize him. But once they decided to go the route of the civilian criminal justice system, it was inevitable that that would be exactly what happened. And because I think the public hears Miranda in connection with these kinds of terrorist atrocities and finds that to be a deeply unpopular way to handle the cases, so the administration tried to slough it off on the magistrate judge, who came to the hospital room of the person who's in custody, Tsarnaev. Yes, but it wasn't the magistrate's fault. I mean, basically, the administration ran into civilian court less than 2 days after Tsarnaev was apprehended and filed a criminal complaint, even though there was no rush to do that. When you file a criminal complaint, the federal rules of criminal procedure require that there be a presentment proceeding, and at that proceeding, the magistrate judge is supposed to advise the person of his rights and make sure that he has counsel. So, basically, it's the end of questioning. So,
and where do you think, Andy McCarthy, that decision came from? Was that the president?
Was that Holder?
Eric Holder, Attorney General of the United States.
There's no way that decision gets made in the Justice Department without the Attorney General blessing it. This is the most important case in the United States.
Do you think that the president would have been involved as well, or at least consulted?
I don't think the president needs to be consulted, Frank, because he's made very clear philosophically that he believes that these cases belong in the civilian court. I don't think he and Holder...
There's no daylight there.
You and I are usually like-minded on these things. There's a lot of things that we don't need to discuss, and yet I know exactly how you're going to come out, and you know how I'm going to come out. I don't think it's any different with those guys.
No, I think you're probably right. And you've also written about the another matter of concern in the Holder Justice Department, particularly among the so-called Gitmo Bar that is well represented there. That would be the need to close Guantanamo Bay, a renewed priority for the president, perhaps in part at least animated by this hunger strike that's now underway. Talk to us a little bit about that and how it fits into the larger agenda of the jihadists who are engaged in it.
Well, of course, President Obama famously on his first day in office committed to close Guantanamo Bay. And then I think, reality and the fact that he's accountable for our national security intruded. So the facility has remained open, even though they've been slowly repatriating a number of the jihadists held there. There's now about 166 left. Of that number, about 100 of them have begun this hunger strike, and that prompted the president, now that he's been safely reelected, to revisit the issue of Guantanamo Bay, which he's been under a lot of heat from his left-wing base to close and to honor the commitment that he made. And it seems Obama was prompted by this hunger strike, but his reaction to it is incoherent because the hunger strikers, the jihadists, are not striking because they're at Guantanamo Bay. They're striking because they are in custody without the prospect of a civilian trial, and that wouldn't change whether they were in Guantanamo Bay or any place else. The only thing that would change is if Obama has his way and gets to bring them here, the federal courts will unquestionably have jurisdiction over them for all purposes, and it's entirely foreseeable that one or more judges would hold that some of these guys have to be released in the United States.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Andy, one other aspect of this which I was puzzled by, and since you are much more knowledgeable about it than I hope you can explain it. The president, in making this pronouncement that it was, unacceptable to continue to operate Guantanamo Bay, I believe made some thing to the following effect, a statement to the following effect, namely that we mustn't be allowed to hold people indefinitely without trial.
Right.
And I thought that he had previously taken the position that even if he brought them back to the United States as he would like, that there are some people who are simply not going to be able to be given a trial for a variety of reasons. Have I missed something here, or is there another incoherence manifesting itself there?
Well, I mean, I guess if your Rosetta Stone is political expedience in the moment, then none of this is incoherent. It's completely explainable. But yes, when Obama needed to show that he was strong for purposes of national security to package himself politically to be elected and reelected, certainly, he pointed to the fact that he was tough on terrorists. Gitmo remained open, and in fact, for a guy who's got a preternatural interest in the due process accorded to jihadists, he had no problem, at least when it's thousands of miles away and out of sight and virtually out of mind, snuffing these guys out with Hellfire missiles without any authorization from the federal courts. But now that he's been reelected, he's back to appealing to his base and taking the position that he took back in the old days of 2007, 2008, which is that the Bush counterterrorism model is a travesty, and that you can't hold people without trial, even though he's been killing people without trial.
Yeah, so, and holding them for that matter.
Can't really take seriously much of what he says.
and for that matter, holding them as well. No, you can't. But
must have been one of those red lines.
I guess breached and ignored. Let me ask you finally, Andy, one other important question. You did some drilling down on a recent survey of public opinion in the Muslim world conducted by the Pew Foundation, and found that there were some extraordinary omissions, and that may have contributed to an equally extraordinary flaw in the sort of analysis itself. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, the Pew poll is basically a report on the attitudes of Muslims about law, religion, and society, which really means how Sharia operates and what they think about Sharia. But they left out the three most Sharia compliant countries in the world, namely Saudi Arabia and Iran, where Sharia is the only law. And Sudan, where it's close to the only law and will be the only law once they finally do their new constitution. So I thought it was a little peculiar to be reporting the attitudes about Muslims about Sharia and leave out the 150 million or so Muslims who live under the strictest Sharia provision.
Yeah, it would seem like a rather remarkable omission. And it gave rise to a position that they took in the study that Sharia is loosely defined. You wouldn't find that so in Saudi or Iran, for sure, or Sudan, for that matter,
right.
or I suspect any place else. Tell us very quickly about that, Andy. We've got about half a minute.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. You know, when they leave this stuff out, it gives rise to the standard leftist argument that there is no real Sharia. It's just aspirational and an internal compass. And of course, you know, when people get stoned in Sharia countries, it's not aspirations that people are puffing at them.
Yeah, and it's not good for their health either. Andy McCarthy, thank you for your brevity in responding to that question. This is really important, folks. There is a knowable and very rigid Sharia, and people are trying to apply it worldwide, including to us here at home. Andy McCarthy, nobody understands that better or discusses it more fully and carefully and thoughtfully and effectively than you. Thank you for doing it with us. Come back to us again very soon. soon. Next up, Sean Waterman joins us from the Washington Times. We'll talk with him about the Benghazi gate affair and the hearings being held tomorrow. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. For over 7 months, the truth has been hidden about a terrorist attack that killed 4 Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. We still don't know why our ambassador was in that dangerous place on a day Islamists have made dangerous for all of us, or why we were repeatedly told that a mob, not jihadist, killed him and his comrades, or why no effective rescue effort was mounted. So 700 of my fellow Special Forces veterans who have participated in such efforts in the past have teamed up to learn the truth and to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. To see a copy of our open letter to House Speaker John Boehner calling for a real investigation of Benghazi Gate and to urge your representative to do the same, go to www.inthecoverup.com, a project of the Center for Security Policy. Thank you.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Obama administration sure seems determined to destroy the U.S. military. The president is insisting on Pentagon spending cuts that are hollowing out our armed forces as he negotiates away our missile defenses and abandons our nuclear deterrent. Then there are the serial attacks on the culture of the military, from imposing open homosexuality to obliging women to serve in combat. Army reservists have been trained to view Catholics and evangelical Christians as extremists on a par with Al-Qaeda. And the Air Force is taking counsel from someone who thinks Christians in uniform are monsters who should be prosecuted for treason if they share their faith with other service personnel. Heaven help us if, after all this, it turns out we once again need the military. Our commander-in-chief is breaking. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me. Coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone.
I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Mike Gallagher doesn't apologize for speaking the truth.
People are not economically equal. They never have been.
They never will be.
But we believe in giving people the opportunity to try to become financially successful.
How are you going to make a janitor economically equal to a CEO?
But that's what this fierce liberal mindset tries to suggest. And then everybody's happy. Right?
Right.
Wrong.
The Mike Gallagher Show. Weekdays from 9 to noon on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We are joined now by Sean Waterman. He is a prize-winning Washington Times correspondent covering the very important portfolios of foreign affairs, defense, and cybersecurity. He has a long and storied record in the Fourth Estate, having served as a senior editor and correspondent for United Press International, and was a senior producer for the BBC's flagship evening radio news program called The World Tonight. John Waterman, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
I'm blushing, Frank. Thank you very much.
All deserved, and a very, very great background to draw upon for some of the reporting that you're doing at the moment, and even the mainstream media, as they call themselves, seems now to be finally picking up upon, based on a front page story in the Washington Post today. But you've been on the case for months now of Benghazi Gate, as I like to think of it, and the story of what happened in the run-up to, during, and then in the aftermath of an attack on our so-called special mission compound and CIA annex in Benghazi, Libya, on the 11th of September, 2012. A hearing is to take place tomorrow in the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Tell us a bit about what has been happening of late and what we might expect to have come out of this hearing tomorrow.
Well, I think that the staff on the committee have been quite industriously making parts of the research that they've done to prepare for this hearing available to the press over the last few days. And so, as you say, we've seen, you know, this come up on the Sunday talk shows and on the network programs and this morning on the front page of the Post. The gist of it is, Frank, that we're going to hear from three officials, State Department officials, tomorrow, one of whom, Eric Nordstrom, we heard from in October. He was the guy who talked about the warnings that staff on the ground in Libya had passed up the chain to the State Department about the deteriorating security situation in Benghazi and about the requests for additional security that they made, which went unanswered or were turned down. So, but we're also going to hear from a fellow called Gregory Hicks, who is actually Chris Stevens' deputy, and who, you know, sadly became the chief of mission at 3 a.m. When Chris Stevens was found to be dead. Now, what he...
He was based in Tripoli at the time.
He was in Tripoli, yes. And, I mean, I think, you know, the other thing that's happened is that the staff there have come up with a lot of the email traffic surrounding the drafting of these so-called talking points, which was basically supposed to be an unclassified summary of what was known by the U.S. intelligence community about the attacks, you know, a few days afterwards. I think it was Friday after the Tuesday attacks. Anyhow, I mean, Mr. Hicks apparently told investigators that his jaw hit the floor when he heard Susan Rice on the Sunday talk shows following the attack, you know, talk about it being a spontaneous protest against this U.S.-made anti-Islam video that got out of hand. I mean, even though he'd been in Tripoli, he knew there was no protest.
This had nothing to do, in short, with a video, as we were told relentlessly by, among others, Susan Rice, but also, of course, the President of the United States.
And I mean, you've got to remember that in the initial hours and even perhaps days, you know, it's understandable there might be some confusion. There had been these very violent protests, riots indeed, really, about the video in the... in neighboring countries, you know, in Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Yemen, you know, in those few days. And, you know, I think it's understandable in the first few hours. But this was, you know, 5 or 6 days afterwards. And, you know, the other thing to remember, Frank, is that it was during an election campaign. And what we now know, you know, from these emails, is that White House and State Department officials played what seems to be a much larger role than they've previously acknowledged.
Direct role in the rewrite, it seems.
Yes.
And one point that I just want to make plain to our audience, Sean Waterman, is that the testimony that we'll be hearing more of tomorrow indicates that, in fact, within 8 minutes of the attack, Christopher Stevens was on the phone telling Eric and I think others that they were, in fact, under attack. So it was clear that this was a jihadist sort of enterprise, not simply the mob going south. Is that right?
Well, I think it was clear to the to the people in Benghazi and soon to the people in Tripoli. I think it may have been less clear to the people in Washington. Now, we do know that there was real-time, you know, communication that people in Tripoli and in Benghazi itself were, you know, in very close communication with officials in Washington.
Yeah, it seems to me, but we'll certainly know more later, Sean, that the White House and State Department folks were being kept pretty much in the loop on this. Certainly, as you say, within a few hours, if not minutes, they were aware of what was going on. What, Sean, let me just ask you this. What we're beginning to see with these whistleblowers tomorrow and then evidently others that are still in the wing, some of whom were on the ground in Libya, but who have not been heard from yet. They're seeking legal counsel. They've been evidently threatened with job action and maybe worse if they testified. Is kind of an unraveling of the party line on this. What role do you think the so-called Accountability Review Board, co-chaired by former Ambassador Tom Pickering and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mike Mullen, played in obscuring rather than accurately portraying some of the facts that are now beginning to come to light?
Well, I'm not clear that that's entirely right, Frank. I mean, I think that what is certainly unraveling is the story about the talking points, okay? And that is, you know, that is bad enough, frankly, because, you know, that was the original, if you think back to September, that was the original point of controversy, is why the White House took so long to call this, to acknowledge that this was, in fact, a terrorist attack. And I think that that's the, you know, I'm not sure from the excerpts that we've seen so far from Mr. Hicks's testimony that he's really going to cast any doubt on the Accountability Review Board. I mean, for example, he says that they couldn't do a flyover with an F-15, which he believes may have, you know, perhaps scared off the attackers and prevented the second wave of attacks at dawn the following morning, which killed the two former Navy SEALs, Glenn Doherty and Tyrone Woods. And, you know, he says that they couldn't do that because they didn't have any in-flight refueling capability. And that's basically what the ARB said as well. So, I mean, question of the immediate response is where the administration is going to have problems, Frank. I think it's going to be on the talking points and the way they tried to spin this to say it wasn't terrorism, because that interfered with the narrative they had for the election campaign about you know, Al-Qaeda being on the ropes.
I think that's all true, Sean, and you're probably right. That will be the point at which the hearing turns tomorrow, and there will be much hay made of it, I suspect. I have the feeling that there's more that has yet to come to light on the response, and most especially where the president was in all of this, what orders he was providing to try to assist these people or not. Sean, we have to leave it at that for the moment, though, but we will be talking with you, I hope, after the hearing and in the days ahead frequently. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to the rest of you for doing so as well. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.